You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Americans are disrupting the status quo for social and political change. We'll find out about the rise of protest movements around the country.
First, it's a big day for America's national parks.
In California's beautiful Yosemite Valley, sailors on leave from battle zones enjoy a well-earned rest amid the peace and quiet of scenic national parks.
Virginia, inspiring his forest army by a personal visit, President Roosevelt makes his first tour of the Civilian Conservation Corps camps in the Shenandoah Valley.
In magnificent natural beauty of the American national parks have gone many companies of the Civilian Conservation Corps to further projects which will guard this wealth of beauty against destruction by man and nature.
100 years ago today, then-President Woodrow Wilson signed a bill into law that established the National Park Service, an agency charged with protecting and conserving some of the nation's most natural and historic areas, but also to encourage Americans to get out and enjoy them. Today, the Park Service maintains over 400 national parks and monuments across the country.
Well, getting to 100 years is a major milestone. Our national parks do face some significant hurdles in the coming years. The Park Service estimates that the parks are in need of over $12 billion in repairs and renovations. Others worry that we're loving our national parks to death and that too many visitors to those parks threaten the well-being of the natural areas the Park Service is trying to protect.
Here with us now to talk about the past, the present, and the future of the national parks is James Mills. He's an outdoors enthusiast, freelance journalist, and the founder of the Joy Trip Project. James, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hey, Rob.
Veronica, thanks for having me.
So, James, 100 years of national parks, it's a big milestone, a success story by most counts. So how big a deal is this, and what do you know about what went into that success?
Well, I frankly think it's a huge deal because it represents one of the great histories and heritage and legacies of our country, you know, but also our culture. And I really think that it's an amazing opportunity to celebrate and to embrace our natural world. And with events going on all over the country, I think this is an exciting site to spend time in the outdoors and hopefully get a chance to visit some of our national parks and our monuments around the country.
And you are a big fan of enjoying the natural world, the national parks. What do you love best about getting out to our national parks?
Yeah, I think what I love most is just the pristine and awe-inspiring beauty. I mean, when you take a look at places like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite or Yellowstone, you know, or even some of the lesser known or lesser utilized parks like Joshua Tree or the Shenandoah Battlefield that we had talked about earlier. I mean, there are some amazing places that represent not only the natural beauty of our country, but also our longstanding history, both as, you know, human beings, but also as Americans.
It could be tempting 100 years in, these parks are household names in a lot of cases, Yellowstone, Yosemite, to not think about what they might need to stay solvent and to keep drawing people and new people and not just the same people. So what are some of the challenges that the national parks are facing?
Well, I think you mentioned in your introduction that repairs and maintenance for the national parks is $12 billion in arrears. I mean, that is a lot of bathroom cleanups. That's a lot of trail maintenance. That's a lot of road repair. One of the biggest challenges right now is getting funds allocated from members of Congress to make sure that we do indeed have the ability to keep these national parks and monuments going well into the future. And, you know, and unfortunately, because you know, we just, you know, as a society haven't decided that not only are they worth protecting and preserving, they're also worth paying for. Now, granted, we definitely have park fees, but oddly enough, I mean, our park fees are actually relatively low compared to other types of amenities that we can enjoy in, for example, theme parks like Disneyland. But at the same time, you know, we need to allocate, in my opinion, more funds to make sure that the parks are cared for through the present and well into the future.
As we heard in that newsreel footage, there was a big effort with Civilian Conservation Corps about 20 years into the national park history. On the 50th anniversary of the parks, there's a big reinvestment and expansion Is there the will? I mean, you said it hasn't happened. Do you think there's enthusiasm to consider doing a big project like that now?
Well, as it happens, Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell basically created what she calls the Civilian Conservation Corps of the 21st Century. And there has been indeed a big push to get young people in particular involved, engaged in national park preservation, but, you know, not just the trail maintenance and the road building and the bridge building, but also interpretation, you know, making sure that there's conversations going on in the parks with people in the community that will actually learn why these places are so important to protect. Now, unfortunately, this was an unfunded mandate. There was not very much money invested in this on the federal level, but millions and millions of dollars were actually privately donated from corporations across the country who recognized the importance of this. And for example, the automobile company Subaru invested quite a bit of money in the Find Your Park campaign, which is going on right now. And so that there are private entities that are working to protect and preserve these places with their dollars. But frankly, I would love to see the federal government through acts of the Senate and Congress to allocate these funds long term into the future.
We're talking with James Mills right now. He's an independent media producer and a freelance journalist, talking about the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. And James, let's talk about the parks themselves. For those of us who want to use this 100th anniversary to get out there and explore some parks maybe we haven't been to, where do we start? There's so many.
You know, and as it happens, you know, I think that a lot of people kind of get put off by the notion that the parks are so big and they're so far away. Oddly enough, I really think that the best place to establish your love and appreciation for national parks is to start with your local parks. I mean, not too far here in Madison, there's Devil's Lake State Park, and it's probably one of the most beautifully maintained recreational areas in the state, with hiking trails and bike paths and a fabulous lake to swim and paddle and fish in. And I really think that once you start making that short sojourn, you know, not too far away from town, a longer drive, you know, perhaps over the course of, you know, an overnight trip, or maybe even deciding to, you know, get on a plane and flying to a destination and then ultimately driving to get there. I mean, for example, just about 2 weeks ago, I flew to Los Angeles and drove 5 hours to get to Yosemite National Park. 2 weeks prior to the, 3 weeks prior to that, I flew into Flagstaff, Arizona, then drove to the Grand Canyon. There are many places that you can get to. Frankly, I always believe that if there is indeed a will, there is definitely a way.
And you founded the Joy Trip Project to help connect people to nature in particular, I think. Can you talk about that and the national parks?
Sure. Yeah, I think that, you know, as a freelance journalist, I mean, one of the great things about the internet is that I have the ability to publish myself. And in those on those occasions where I couldn't necessarily convince a magazine to which I've previously contributed to, like National Geographic Adventure or the Sierra Magazine, Rock and Ice Climbing, different other national publications, the Joy Trip Project was basically a place where I could literally write every day and produce short videos and photographs and to kind of share with my audience, both locally and nationally, some of the things that I'm doing either in our national parks or in our public lands. And also, you know, I've done projects in foreign countries. For example, last year, I visited 5 national parks of Tanzania, Africa. Mm. You know, and oddly enough, one of the things that I discovered there is that they have the exact same issues that we have here. You know, making sure that more people and more varieties of different people use those parks and those resources so that they ultimately represent the whole preponderance of the populace, so that it's not just upwardly mobile people with wealth and with leisure time and the ability to, you know, to have the disposable income to take advantage of these things. It is indeed open to everyone.
And James, can you spend our last minute basically just inspiring us, telling us about a couple of the parks, maybe 2 or 3 that you've been to, and the most breathtaking thing that you saw or experienced that still stays with you?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, I just went to the Grand Canyon. And for many of your listeners who will probably visit the rim of the Grand Canyon, 4.5 million people a year visit the rim of the Grand Canyon. But this year, I was one of the 29,000 people that actually go through the Grand Canyon. And in this case, in a on a 16-person river expedition over the course of 16 days, paddling rubber rafts from one end of the Grand Canyon to the other.
Wow.
And I can tell you that one of the things that was most amazing to me was the colors. I mean, the light refracting on various different types of granite and sandstone create the most amazing views that you could possibly imagine. And it looks remarkable from the top down, but from the bottom up, the view is spectacular. And what's especially great about the Grand Canyon and other resources like it, because they limit the number of people that go there, they ultimately have the ability to preserve the area so that I can come back and tell these stories. But more than anything else, I want to make sure that people put in the time to get down there. Now, the punchline to the story is that I was part of an expedition that was literally 15 years in the making. A friend of mine who invited me to come along on this expedition had put in his first application to get a permit to paddle the Grand Canyon well over a decade ago. And it literally took that long. But I got to tell you, it was definitely worth the wait.
James, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was James Mills, independent media producer and freelance journalist. He's the author of The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. And he was with us to talk about the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, as Donald Trump is trailing Hillary Clinton by a wide margin in Wisconsin, a new group calling itself Wisconsin Women for Trump are hoping to change that. We'll take a look at what Donald Trump needs to do to win in Wisconsin.
First, our next guest has been tracking social movements around the country, from the birth of the Tea Party to Occupy Wall Street and the Act 10 protests here in Wisconsin. She says the U.S. is seeing a spike in social activism that has the power to remake politics and the world as we know it.
Sarah Jaffe joins us now. She's a Nation Institute fellow and an independent journalist. Her new book is called Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been following social movements as they spring up around the country, movements on the left like Occupy Wall Street and also movements on the right like the Tea Party, along with Black Lives Matter and the Fight for 15 and the protests after Act 10. And you say that they seem different, but they have a lot in common. How would you describe that common ground between them?
You know, I think the thing that they have in common is that Americans are feeling like elites have failed them. The people who are supposed to know what's going on and be in charge are not doing a very good job of it, and that we have to do something about it. And that doing something is more than just voting. It's people getting out in the streets, in the occupying the Wisconsin Capitol, and disrupting business as usual in order to make their demands heard.
Do you think these groups perceive that what you're saying, that they may have things in common? Someone like a man you interviewed who became a Tea Party activist, J.D. Meadows, that he has something in common with the Occupy Wall Street folks?
I mean, I didn't talk to him. I actually tried to find J.D. Meadows, and I could not track him back down. So if he happens to be listening, I would love to interview him. So I didn't get a chance to talk to him after Occupy to find out what he thought. I really wanted to. But there are certainly people that I did talk to, like Debbie Dooley, who is a Tea Party activist and also part of something called the Green Tea Party, because she is for solar power in particular and concerns about environmental issues in general. And she did express that she had some things in common with people, and indeed the Atlanta Tea Party had worked on a protest with some labor unions and with Occupy people when an anti-protesting bill was put forward by the Georgia State Legislature.
And it seems like since 2008, I guess, the financial collapse, there has been a spike in social and political activism. How would you describe what's going on that is fueling all of these different movements that we keep seeing year after year?
You know, I think that the financial crisis was a big moment in world history. I think we'll look back on it and go, wow, this is when things really changed. And, you know, what happened in that moment was we really saw a crisis in the political economic system that we're used to living under. You know, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, it had been, you know, capitalism is the only way, everything else fails. And then capitalism kind of almost failed. And so that's a big shock to people who are used to that being just the way things are.
I mean, we saw a lot of social ferment and social and political movements in the 60s. It hasn't been as prevalent as that since then. So looking back in history, do you see any parallels with the moment that we're living in right now and other areas that might look similar in the rearview mirror?
You know, I mean, I think there are a lot of things in common with the 60s, obviously, but I really do look at the Depression more than the 60s in this moment because, as somebody was saying to me earlier today, the economy was pretty good in the 50s and 60s when the civil rights movement and other protests started. And really, you know, the shock of the Depression was that the economy had collapsed and that people were really struggling. And we're not quite at those conditions now, and so the problem with that is it almost leads people to complacency. If you're doing okay, it's easy to sort of not notice the people who are still struggling. And then, you know, we get election season and we get Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and people are like, why are people so angry? I didn't realize people were still angry. And it's like if you, you know, outside of a few centers of media where most of the election reporting comes from, people are mad and people are still doing things about it.
What is different about the protests we're seeing today? I know one word you use to describe them is horizontal. You want to tell us about that and what else is different?
Yeah, I think the horizontal structure, which is basically a leaderless, a sort of broad structure where a lot of people take power within the movement, which is something that we saw in the way the Tea Party spread as well. This is both a reaction to a moment where Americans feel like elites have failed them and also a part and parcel of the way that these things are spreading, because they're spreading via the internet, right? People are sort of replicating something that they see somewhere else, and so these things spread very quickly rather than waiting for, you know, this leader or that leader to come to your city and have, you know, have a big march. You go organize your own march.
Sarah Jaffe is with us now. She's the author of a new book called Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. And we're talking about the rise of protest movements, social movements in the United States. And Sarah, you write about Wisconsin during the Act 10 protests. And you say that those protests were pioneering in one way, in particular the way they use social media. What stood out to you there?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of things, actually. I think that the Wisconsin protests also sort of pioneered the kinds of occupations that we've now seen repeat in several of these protests. But also, you know, in terms of the use of social media, Wisconsin, I was in New York, and I was watching this on Twitter. The people that I interviewed for the book are people that I met, quote, met in air quotes, on Twitter during the protests. I watched in real time as this stuff was happening, as the major media outlets were kind of ignoring this until it got too big to ignore. And so, you know, there was Twitter, there was Facebook, there were Facebook groups used to organize. You know, people around the world were communicating via Twitter. I think it was, everybody kind of forgets that this was going on at the same time as the revolution in Egypt. And there was, I remember so clearly the famous moment where the pizza shop had a pizza called in from Egypt, and it was so exciting. And so, yeah, we saw that. And then, like, as social media has evolved, it was only a few months later that Occupy Wall Street started. But by then, live streaming technology had already improved, and people were really live streaming video straight from their smartphones as things were going on.
And you, in your book, you argue that these movements do have the power to transform society, to affect political and policy change. But, you know, if you look at the protests in Wisconsin, Act 10, you could bill them as a failure. Governor Walker wasn't recalled. Act 10 is still in place. So what is your take? Is there momentum in these movements, even if they don't achieve their objectives at the time?
I mean, I think there is. I think that these things, you know, it's also easy to have, like, too rosy a picture, and I don't want to, you know, pretend that, right, we saw at peak maybe 100,000 people come out in Madison, and Scott Walker survived recall and then was reelected. He notably did not do so well on the presidential campaign trail this year, but, yeah, these things take a while, and it can be really hard. You know, one of the people that I spoke to in my book, Alex Hanna, she really hasn't been active since. It's really hard to sort of recover from these things. And so that's kind of a downside, is that these very, very intense, very disruptive protests that entail often a lot of risk really do, you know, take a lot out of people. And so, you know, we have to think about that as well as the upside. That said, I think that Wisconsin laid the groundwork for Occupy Wall Street. It laid the groundwork for occupations that we're seeing now with the Black Lives Matter movement, where you see the same kinds of structures where people are making child care centers and art centers and have libraries and things while they're camping out and holding public space.
Now you talked about the common ground between these various movements, and I mm-hmm. can see that as a vulnerability, that there are a lot of movements right now that are active and not a lot of coordination between them. Is that a liability when you have too many that it's difficult to get a spotlight shine for too long on any one of them?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of coordination going on that doesn't get reported, because reporting tends to be short-term and tends to be immediate. And so, you know, you have a bunch of reporters go to Ferguson when there are massive, massive protests in the streets, and most of those reporters aren't there now, even though the people who are there are still doing work, they're still organizing, they're still crossing over with other things. So with, like, the Fight for 15, they're communicating with people in other cities, they're really building, and you saw that with the Vision for Black Lives platform that just came out a couple of weeks ago, where 50 different organizations that are involved with the Movement for Black Lives came together and spent a year working on a really, really expansive visionary policy document that, you know, yeah, we didn't think that these people were coordinating with each other. We have very obvious proof that they are, and they're working really hard on it, and that document does include issues like climate change. It includes wages. It includes a moratorium on charter schools. It's a really expansive vision that takes into account a lot of the other issues that have been raised by a lot of these other movements today.
Now, you mentioned the election cycle that we're in now that surprised yeah. some people quite a bit, both with the rise of Bernie Sanders and the rise of Donald Trump. Do you yeah. expect to see more protest movements, social movements spinning out from the cycle, that it's revealed something that we didn't know was there in a way?
I mean, I think we're going to see more, because things have not gotten better, and I don't see a whole lot on offer from the current presidential candidates, either of them, that really takes on the issues at the root of the problem. You know, Donald Trump is talking a pretty good game, so is Hillary Clinton at times, but there's still a lot of frustration. Both of these candidates, while they won their primaries, are vastly unpopular with large swaths of the country. And so, you know, I don't see either of them restoring Americans' faith in authority anytime soon.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Jaffe. She's the author of the new book, Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. And she joined us to talk about the rise of social movements and protest movements in the United States.
Coming up, we'll take a look at Donald Trump's standing in Wisconsin, particularly among women. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's the Moth Radio Hour with a special show featuring stories from Australia. A writer and her daughter move from Aboriginal land to an impoverished community, and a lonely man befriends an orphan monkey. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, a group of prominent Republican women have joined forces to boost Donald Trump's chances of winning Wisconsin in the November presidential election. The new Wisconsin Women for Trump coalition includes Republican Party leaders like former Lieutenant Governor Margaret Farrow and State Senators Alberta Darling and Mary Lozick.
The move comes amid Trump's lagging poll results in Wisconsin, particularly among women. According to the most recent polls, he trails Hillary Clinton by 24 points among registered women voters and 31 points for likely women voters.
Lily Gorin is with us now. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Her books include Women and the White House and Mad Men and Politics. Lily, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on today.
At a press call yesterday, members of this new Wisconsin Women for Trump chimed in on their support for Donald Trump. Here's a listen.
I'm so excited to be throwing my support to Donald Trump, along with some of Wisconsin's finest leading ladies. Wisconsin's enthusiasm for Donald Trump is increasing on a daily basis. America needs to change direction, and Trump is a candidate to do that.
That was Judy Marshman, former president of the Wisconsin Federation of Republican Women. So looking at poll results, Lily, are we seeing any kind of uptick in support, as far as we can measure it, for Donald Trump in Wisconsin and especially among women?
Well, I haven't seen a dramatic shift of late, and of course this group is only, what, a day or two old. So we haven't had a new poll since they were established, but Donald Trump was weaker, you know, than Ted Cruz during the election in the primary season in the winter. And Cruz obviously carried the state, and Cruz also did a lot better than Trump did with regard to women in the state of Wisconsin during the primary season as well. So in comparison to the primary, obviously Trump has some work to do in Wisconsin. And then in general, you know, this has been sort of an ongoing issue with regard to Trump's polls, not only in Wisconsin, but across the country, that he isn't carrying women very strongly in a lot of different places.
Is there typically a big gender gap between Democratic and Republican presidential candidates? And how does Donald Trump compare to the norm in a presidential election?
Well, the polls that I've been seeing show a greater gender gap than we've seen in the past. The tendency is that there has been a gender gap. I think this goes back to about Reagan in 80 and 84. But what you're seeing now is or at least the polls are showing sort of a more pronounced gap in the double digits in particular with regard to Trump versus Clinton, not only in state-level polls, but also in national polls.
A question that keeps coming up lately is how much in politics is partisan affiliation, which party a voter is a part of, the candidate is a part of, versus the characteristics of the individual candidates themselves. What does this election now with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton as the standard bearers tell us anything about that question?
Well, I think you can see if you dig into a number of these polls that both Trump and Clinton have fairly high negatives. And so if only one of them had fairly high negatives, then you could sort of say that, you know, that was pulling the candidate, that particular candidate down. But their negatives are almost on par with one another. And so what that does is, to some degree, it evens the playing field. So then it becomes the question of, you know, if you want to start parsing into the polls with regard to gender, race, and so forth, then you see some of these splits, very sort of pronounced splits, between where Hillary Clinton is galvanizing support with women, with African Americans, with Hispanic Americans, and where Trump is galvanizing support predominantly with white men.
We're talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at Donald Trump's prospects here in Wisconsin, a new effort among Republican women in particular to drum up support for Trump. Lily, we look at a lot of different voting blocks, especially during presidential elections. With women, I mean, that's, you know, just over half the population. Does it make sense in a lot of ways to talk about women as a voting block or an interest group in a presidential election?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, obviously not all women think the same way. Not all men think the same way. You know, not all Christians think the same way. So, you know, you do have these kind of really broad categories that you're talking about when you start talking about gender, half the population, slightly more. But when you do see poll results that are indicating, you know, such dramatic shifts, or, you know, sort of separations between men on one side or women on the other, then that may be cause for paying a little bit more attention to, you know, is this a group that for whatever reason is voting alike, even across, say, age, income bracket, and so forth.
So with an effort like this Wisconsin Women for Trump Coalition, some prominent Republican women in the state, is this something that can give Donald Trump cover in a way among women voters that might help him move the needle?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's per se to give him cover. It's an advocacy group, and so the women who are part of this group are, you know, are going to be out there in the media and in forums, local and across the state, you know, advocating for the Trump candidacy. And so they're, you know, they've come together as a group based on their you know, sort of biological sex. But at the same time, what they're saying is, you know, as a group, we are women who are supporting Donald Trump. And that's how they're, you know, also advocating to others that, you know, perhaps there is a avenue where others can follow them, as it were.
Moving more broadly to the election as a whole, what are Donald Trump's chances here in Wisconsin as we look at the polls right now?
The polls are not strongly in favor of Donald Trump at the moment, from what I've seen. The most recent Marquette poll, which already is, you know, about 15 days old, I think, is the most recent one that I saw. And again, Trump lost to Ted Cruz. Cruz got 48% of the Republican vote in the primary. And so Trump, to some degree, is starting from a bit of a deficit because he didn't carry the state initially. This is one of Ted Cruz's best performances during the primary season, and it was a difficult one for Trump. He did spend time in Wisconsin, so did Cruz, and so did a lot of their surrogates, but it was, you know, it was a state that he didn't do very well in, so he needs to sort of draw the Republican Party of Wisconsin with him. And he's in a situation also where he's, you know, been antagonistic towards Paul Ryan. He and Scott Walker have generally been, you know, fairly friendly when Walker was in the was running for president. But one of the reasons why Walker indicated he left the field when he did was so that people would potentially galvanize against Trump. And so there's been some tension between Trump and a lot of elected Republican officials in Wisconsin.
Now, we see this Wisconsin women's group, this Republican group, trying to advocate for Trump, especially for women voters. This is something that has already been an issue on the Democratic side. Ads run, just replaying Donald Trump's comments regarding women, Megyn Kelly and others. Is this something that you see being a cudgel for Democrats against Donald Trump, trying to widen that gender gap even more?
Well, I have a feeling that, you know, we'll probably see more of the ads where they're, you know, using Donald Trump's own words, which were some of the ads that were also used during the primary season, to advocate for people not to vote for him and to vote for Hillary Clinton or, you know, Gary Johnson. And so Trump has, you know, in public made a lot of these comments. He stood on the debate stage and made comments with regard to Carly Fiorina. He has made a lot of comments that some people do find really problematic with regard to women and to some degree how they look and how they act and so forth.
Lily Gorin is with us. She's professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Tune in Tuesday at the same time. We're going to talk with Lily about how Hillary Clinton's campaign is doing here in Wisconsin.
Right now, we're talking about the Trump campaign in Wisconsin and what Donald Trump would need to do to win the state. And we want to hear from you on this. So if you're a woman, are you likely or unlikely to vote in November? And what does Donald Trump need to do to be successful in Wisconsin, especially among women voters? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email your thoughts to talk@WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about Donald Trump's standing in the Badger State and what he needs to do to win here in November. What do you think? Does Trump have your vote this election or not? And do you think he's becoming more or less appealing to women voters? What do you want to hear from the candidate? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lily Gorin stays with us. She's professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. We're looking at the Trump campaign next Tuesday. By the way, she'll be back with us to look at Hillary Clinton's efforts here in Wisconsin. We'll go to our callers now with Jerry in Armstrong Creek. Jerry, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think this movement is more about making sure that women voters actually come out and vote so they don't lose the U.S. Senate race and the state Senate, lose seats there, and possibly even some in the assembly. Because if these women are so disgusted with Trump that they don't vote, it's a good chance they may swing the Senate back being Democratic.
Jerry, thanks a lot for that call. Lily, Jerry describing what I imagine is a nightmare for Republican leadership in the country, that not only could they lose the presidential race, but Donald Trump could make typically Republican voters stay home, and they could be losing a lot of down-ballot races as well.
Yeah, I mean, this, I think, is a broad-based concern, and I think it's been one that sort of been an undercurrent and now is more, an overt discussion throughout the primary season and now into the general election, that there are a lot of vulnerable Senate seats, including the seat that Ron Johnson holds in Wisconsin. And there is a lot of concern with regard to whether or not Trump will be a drag on the Republican ticket if the poll numbers continue to go in the direction that they have been for the last couple of weeks, that he may pull down other Republicans with him. And so there is definitely advocacy on a variety of fronts to make sure that Republicans come out and vote, whether or not they're supportive of Trump.
Jerry, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Rosemary in Cumberland. Hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm not okay with Trump. If he becomes president, he's going to set everything that women have worked for in the past 60 years. You know, my mother and my grandmother, they're going to set us all back. It's going to go back to the husband owning the women. It blows my mind that women are okay with him and want to vote for him and want him to become president. He made a comment on the television a few weeks ago that if women have abortions, they will be fine, but the man won't. How is that okay? That's not how things work. And I don't understand why it's okay, why women find him okay in Wisconsin, of all places.
Rosemary, thanks a lot for the call. And Lily, at least according to the polling that we've seen so far, a new poll coming out next month from Marquette University, I think many women don't find Donald Trump fine in Wisconsin.
Yeah, he did better. I believe he did slightly better, very slightly better during the primary. Now he did about the same with Cruz. Comparatively, Cruz carried 48% of the men and 48% of the women, and Trump carried 35% on both counts during the primary. And so the primary should indicate again that there was not a huge amount of love for Trump at that time. And the poll numbers that we're seeing from Marquette are also indicating that Trump has some work to do with regard to men and women supporting him during the fall election.
Is gender a bigger issue in this election than usual? A, because of things like what Rosemary was saying about Donald Trump there, but also on the other side of the ballot is a person who could be the country's first female president.
Yeah, you can't really say that gender isn't something that is involved in this election with Hillary Clinton on the ballot. And again, 8 years ago we had Sarah Palin in the vice presidential slot running with John McCain. And so you also had an overt discussion to some degree at that point as well. And Hillary Clinton had run in the primary in 2008. But I do think that, just based on who's on the ballot, this has come forward, as well as there's a lot of discussion about, how the campaigns are operating and what the sort of narratives and the themes of the campaigns are, that also plays into sort of discussions of gender within the campaign and the election season.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, talking about Donald Trump's prospects here in Wisconsin, especially among women with a new group, Wisconsin Women for Trump, kicking off yesterday. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234, especially interested in hearing from women who typically vote Republican. Are you lining up for Trump? Are you not? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234. Back to our callers now. Art is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Art, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I I think Trump is actually going to have an easier time of it than people are estimating that he will. And I think a lot of it has to do with Hillary and creating the mess for herself that she has. And as time goes on and more information comes out about the Clinton Foundation and the email scandals and the pay-for-play that's been going on forever with the Clintons and just how crooked they really are, I think more and more women, I think women are just less likely to trust somebody who's dishonest and proven themselves to be dishonest. And I think that, you know, first woman thing, that doesn't bother me, but just not this woman. And I think more women are going to start to realize just who she really is.
Art, thanks a lot for the call. One word he said there, Lily, was that these stories have been out there forever. Is anything going to happen? I mean, we don't know what will come out, but if we keep seeing the same steady drumbeat of email and Clinton Foundation-related stories we have that haven't changed the polls that much as far as we can tell, are they going to change between now and November?
I mean, it's possible that they might, and it is a sort of, as Art, you know, noted, as you said, that there's the constant drumbeat, which contributes to the narrative with regard to Hillary Clinton being corrupt. But at the same time, this has been sort of going on with regard to both Bill and Hillary for, what, over 30 years now that they've been in the national spotlight. So I'm not necessarily sure that it will have a dramatic impact. But, you know, Hillary Clinton's negatives with regard to how people perceive her are a result also of that going on for 30 years.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Marcia with us in Appleton. Marcia, hi.
Hi. Thank you for letting me be on the show. My concern and thought is that women have issues with trust. And once they've lost their trust in a man, they are very unlikely to get it back. Sometimes we doubt ourselves, but yet we do not trust a man that has been insulting to us. And I think that's been a big issue.
Marcia, thanks for the call. So she's saying women have lost trust in Donald Trump. I don't know if this is true of women voters more than men voters, Lily, but are we at a stage in the election where if people have turned against, say, Donald Trump, they're probably not going to turn back?
Well, I mean, we're not probably quite there, but we're getting close as we, you know, sort of are nearing Labor Day. And, you know, and these two candidates also, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, have been public figures for most of their adult lives. So most voters have name recognition of them, have some idea of who they are. And to some degree, they have drawn a variety of conclusions already. And so, you know, it may be over the course of the next sort of 8 weeks or 10 weeks that we see a bit more of the candidates themselves. But polling experts would suggest that we may have reached as an electorate, we're sort of settling into where we think we're going to be on election day.
So if we don't know them by now, we're never going to know them at all, to quote the song. So given that, Lily, given that we know these candidates pretty well, we know why, in many cases, we don't like one or both of them. What, as we wrap up, is going to be the focus of a Donald Trump campaign in Wisconsin to try to win us over here?
Well, I mean, I think what you've seen with regard to Trump since the convention in particular is that he is articulating or giving a little bit more flesh to some of the policies that he's advocating for, although sometimes some of that's a little bit confusing. This week, I'm a little bit more confused as to where he is on immigration debates. But that, you know, the candidates themselves, we know them as candidates. Is there something that they can tell us that might change our minds? It may have to do with policy prescriptions. And again, how they continue to operate on the campaign trail as well.
Lily, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She'll be with us again at the same time on Tuesday. We've been focusing on the Donald Trump campaign here in Wisconsin. We'll take a closer look at Hillary Clinton's efforts here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.